It is Tuesday, January 10. Can we start over? It is Tuesday, June 10. I wish it was January 10 of last year, because then we get to enjoy all the fun of the postseason and the offseason, although this is the portion of the offseason where it's really not that much fun. It's just kind of getting through the days. Mandatory minicamps, yeah, fine. Contract news, and there will be some contracts that get done here, I believe, in the next week or two. Possibly some guys out of the blue that maybe we're not even thinking about right now. And the question becomes, will we have any holdouts? And at one point, it felt like some of the guys who were taken in the first round of the 2011 draft, who are now eligible for new contracts, would threaten holdouts, would possibly hold out. Because let's face it, a lot of those guys can make the argument that you change the rookie pay system to prevent busts like Jamarcus Russell and Ryan Leaf from taking millions out of the system, and that's fine. But what about us? What about the guys who came in and played really well, from Cam Newton to A.J. Green to J.J. Watt? And I don't want to leave anybody out, but that's just a few of the examples. Patrick Peterson, the guy who possibly will get a new contract as soon as this week if the negotiations continue on their current course. But I thought there'd be more saber-rattling. I thought there'd be a greater sense of urgency, a greater sense of angst. The reality, though, is these guys are all under contract for two more years, and the teams hold all the cards, and they can make any argument they want. Unless they're willing to withhold services, they're really not going to get the team's attention. And the question is, if you do withhold services, you set yourself up for forfeited signing bonus, $30,000 a day in fines for missing training camp, and on it goes. So I don't think that anybody is going to hold out. And if anything, the guys who are going to hold out won't be the guys who could make the most compelling case that, hey, I was stuck with a bad contract. I was stuck with a rookie wage scale. I haven't had a chance to negotiate my own contract. I want to have that chance. I think the guys who would be more likely to hold out are the guys who already have negotiated second and maybe third contracts, from Andre Johnson of the Texans, who, for whatever reason, isn't happy with the $10 million he's due to make this year from the team and is looking presumably for something, maybe not necessarily more money, but he doesn't seem to be very happy, and he may stay away from the mandatory minicamp, even though, again, $10 million coming this year for a guy who is creeping into his 30s. And then Vernon Davis of the 49ers, who knows what he really wants? He's got 2 years left under contract. He says it's not about the money, it's about building his brand, and it's all part of that Fantex stuff, for lack of a more profane term, beginning with bull. But look, I got less sympathy for guys who have signed contracts as veterans and now decide they aren't happy with those deals, aren't happy with their circumstances. They made those commitments. The rookies coming in have no leverage, no options, no alternative short of sitting out for a year. So Vernon Davis, Andre Johnson, you've got contracts. You better have a compelling reason to not honor those contracts. The rookies who have been squeezed by the rookie wage scale and who have overperformed those contracts, they've got a compelling reason. They just don't have any real leverage. Under contract for two more years, if you were a first-round pick, we'll see how many of those guys get new deals and whether we have any type of controversy. And not that I'm looking for things that we can write about, but we would not be upset if there were some stories about how guys may hold out. That would give us something to kind of latch onto as the slow part of the calendar continues to unfold. In Houston, we mentioned Andre Johnson, and if he does show up, someone will be throwing him passes. We just don't know who that will be. They added Ryan Fitzpatrick in free agency. Now, keep in mind, the Titans chose not to pay Fitzpatrick $3.25 million, which is peanuts as far as quarterbacks go. They cut him for Charlie Whitehurst, and Fitzpatrick may be the starting quarterback for the Texans this year. Tom Savage, the rookie from Pitt, a lot of buzz throughout his career, not a whole lot of production. Then you have the holdovers, Case Keenum and T.J. Yates, and Coach Bill O'Brien suggests one of those two guys may get cut sooner rather than later. Now, I don't know why you won't take four camp arms with you into the launch of the official preparation portion of the calendar. You need to have, with 90 guys, up to 90 guys on the roster, you need to have as many arms as you can to throw the ball around. But the problem is they got to teach a new system to all of them. None of these guys know the system. So you put yourself in a box. If you have four guys and you know you're going to be cutting one, maybe two of them at some point, why are you wasting time teaching them how to run a system that is taking away opportunities from the guys who will be there, Fitzpatrick or Savage or whoever? And maybe they'll still trade for Ryan Mallett. I know that no one is really talking about that as a real possibility, but if Fitzpatrick and Savage just can't get it done, it's time to break glass in the event of emergency, and that could be a trade that would bring Ryan Mallett to the Houston Texans. I refuse to rule that out. If Jimmy Garoppolo picks up the offense quickly in New England, and if neither Fitzpatrick nor Savage pick it up in Houston, that could be the time. But something, it feels like something's going to happen sooner rather than later, and who knows. And if I'm a Texans fan, I'm very concerned about what this offense is going to look like this year between Ryan Fitzpatrick and Tom Savage. It could look a lot like last year without a whole lot of hope for 2014. Maybe the hope would be you find your franchise quarterback come 2015. There's a lot of hope in Oakland, not necessarily hope for a Super Bowl, hope we're not 4-12, hope we're competitive, hope that maybe we could find a way to be in contention for a playoff spot. But Coach Dennis Allen is hoping that his guys don't play any basketball. And, you know, this is a never-ending issue when it comes to NFL players in the offseason. Now, Allen isn't happy with the fact that the Raiders participated, some of the players participated, in a charity basketball game. Look, guys play basketball in the offseason all the time, and sometimes guys get injured, whether it's Terrell Suggs, who apparently, possibly, I think he was the one who may have torn the Achilles last year playing basketball. Look, the alternative is when guys are on their own time, they're going to be sitting around playing video games, watching TV, eating pork rinds, getting out of shape. Basketball is, as far as overall risks go, a fairly low-risk way of staying in shape, especially when you're an elite professional athlete. A lot of people play basketball to stay in shape. I would accept that risk. If I'm Dennis Allen or any other coach or trainer or GM or owner, you accept that risk. You encourage your guys to find a way to stay in shape, and you recognize that a fluke thing could happen. You deal with it if it does. They're going to be exposed to a lot more risk of injury when they show up for training camp, preseason, and the regular season. At least they'll be in better shape and maybe in better position to withstand or recover from those injuries if they have been playing basketball or doing something just to mix it up, cross-training. Remember, that was such a big thing way back when. I mean, you don't want to do the same thing all the time. You want to use the different muscles. You want to do different things, and I don't know why any head coach would have a problem with it. I understand you'd be worried about your guys getting injured. But of all the things that an NFL head coach has to worry about in this day and age, having one of my players suffer an injury that would be anything more than a 2 or 3 day thing while playing basketball in the offseason would be very, very low on the list of things about which to worry. So what we're going to worry about is taking a quick break, and then we're going to worry about what questions to ask Bob Glauber of Newsday, because he's such a fountain of information. I want to ask the right questions to get the most out of the limited time we have with him. And then you have limited time to ask me questions. Well, look, if you call in and ask a long question, we'll let you go until it just gets to the point where it's almost as tedious as this monologue. But that's what we'll do to end the show. And we know we won't have long Twitter questions, or otherwise we just wouldn't have added them to the list of questions that I'll try to answer. So that ends the show, as it seems to do more often than not recently. And then a return visit from our good friend Bob Glauber of Newsday. Talk some Giants, talk some Jets, talk some NFL generally, talk about whatever comes up. You'll find out what we do talk about after the break if you stay with us, and I hope you do. We'll be right back. This is PFT Live. We visit from time to time with our good friend Bob Glauber of Newsday to talk about all sorts of things. He's particularly dialed into the Jets and the Giants, but he's also dialed into everything that's going on of interest in the National Football League. And Bob joins us now. Mr. Glauber, Glauber. It's Glauber, isn't it? I always say Glauber, and it's Glauber. It's, you know, Glauber, it's, right?
It's technically it's Glauber, but it's Glauber, and for you, it just sounds, Glauber's fine. I've kind of, that's my pet name, Glauber. You can use it.
What do you prefer? What do you prefer?
I prefer either one. I mean, I go by Glauber, but when people say Glauber, it's usually people I like and I'm friendly with, so it's fine.
All right. Well, I will call you either one, depending upon what other thoughts are ricocheting through my mind at any given moment. I got plenty of thoughts ricocheting through my mind about plenty of topics. And let's start with Joe Namath, who has addressed on multiple occasions Johnny Manziel, most recently NFL Network. He was talking about his views on Manziel. Give the guy some room. Let him live his life. He's a young kid. But also Namath acknowledges that if the world was the way it is now when he was playing back in the late 60s and 70s, maybe Joe Willie wouldn't have been Broadway Joe. You've talked to him about that previously. What's your sense of how Namath would try to strike the balance between being young and having fun and living your life versus, you know, getting yourself in trouble as it relates to social media?
You know, it's really an interesting dynamic, Mike, and I did talk to Namath a couple weeks ago about it, before the Super Bowl, actually, and, you know, this was Broadway Joe's time, and I asked him, if today's NFL, or if your era of the NFL were like it is today with social media and everything under the microscope, would you have been the same way? Would you have behaved the same way? He said, absolutely not. And he said, I, you know, there's just so much attention. And even when Namath was going out and cavorting in New York, there was a lot of attention, but it didn't get the kind of attention that Johnny Manziel gets, say, for, you know, drinking champagne on an inflatable swan, for instance, or going to Vegas and hanging out. There's just so much attention on Manziel. And Namath said, it wasn't that way. I could go out. I had space. So, but I guarantee you that if there were Twitter, if there were Facebook, if there were social media and all the attention, I wouldn't have been that way. Because why? Because it would have affected my teammates more than it actually did. Now, I think Joe struck a balance in his own way between having a good time, being the playboy, being the center of the media attention, but still having enough wherewithal to be a functioning and elite player. And a guy who was great in his own locker room. I think the challenge for Manziel is going to be greater, because I think that he is going to be obviously much more a center of attention. Anything he does is going to be subject to scrutiny, and he's going to have to really dial it in. Now, you know, some people say, well, just let him live his life. It's fine. And he's a kid. Okay. I get that. But I also go back to when Manziel spoke at the Combine, and he was, you know, a little bit, maybe too straight back then. He said, you know, I am going to be a professional once I'm drafted. I'm going to devote my time 24/7 to football. It's easy. I'm going to put my college in days in the past. That's not going to be a problem, because people's careers are on the line. Coaches, families are on the line for what I do. I found it to be interesting when he said it. Yeah, pretty mature thought. I don't know that he's going to follow up on that. I think Johnny's going to be Johnny, and, you know, he's going to create a lot of distraction. I think Mike Pettine's going to have to answer a lot of questions about Johnny Manziel behaving the way he does, and fine. But, you know, you've got some people with issues on that team with substance abuse. Not saying Johnny Manziel is abusing substances, but, you know, you're talking about lifestyle here, and you're talking about other players looking at Johnny Manziel, and if it's okay for him to, you know, go nuts and, you know, not without any consequence. Well, I don't know. What message does it send to your other players? I think he's going to have to strike a fine balance. I think Mike Pettine's going to have his work cut out trying to balance Johnny Manziel, the football player, versus Johnny Manziel, the social media symbol of, you know, all this attention.
Yeah, I get the impression that they have no concerns how he lives his life away from the field, as long as he does everything the team expects him to do when it's time to show up for work. And my concern when we look at that, and I try to impress this on my son, who's 17 and will be 18 sooner than I care to admit, the idea that you get a sense of where the line is, and then you create a buffer. So you're never in position where you're accused, rightfully or wrongfully, of doing something you shouldn't have been doing. And when I see Johnny Manziel spraying champagne on strangers, when I see Johnny Manziel on an inflatable swan, or whatever that thing was, with a bottle of champagne, I just wonder if he's staying far enough away from the line to avoid finding what my dad would have called a jackpot. And I still don't understand why jackpot is a bad thing. I thought it was a good thing, but the way my dad used it, he meant it's a bad thing to have a jackpot. And maybe it is, based on everyone who ever wins a lottery, but be that as it may, are you concerned that maybe he's drifting too close to that line, wherever that line may be?
Yeah, I am. I am, quite frankly, because I think Johnny Manziel seeks out that line. I think in his mind, he wants to kind of push the envelope in terms of having fun. And it's fine to have fun. And I don't begrudge anyone that, and no one should begrudge anyone that. But, you know, there's a way to have fun and be responsible to the people around you, especially in a position of leadership, like the quarterback position. You know, we've seen it too many times where, and, you know, people say, well, Favre did that stuff. Yes, Favre did that stuff. Favre went nuts. And, you know, other quarterbacks have had lifestyles where they certainly had their fun. But it wasn't in an era that it is now. So I think people change. I've changed the way, you know, you're mindful of things. We all have to change and adjust to the reality of what happens today. And I think Manziel has to do that. So you can't have it one way, saying that the combine, I'm going to be a professional and I'm going to devote my time 24/7 to whatever team drafts me. You can't say that. And then, you know, you're going around, you're pushing the envelope right away, weeks into your stint as that professional. So, again, I think Manziel seeks out that line. And he's a bit of a rebel. Partly that's part of what makes him good, because he, you know, he challenges things and he does that athletically. But I just think he's going to have to watch it. I think the Browns are going to have to be mindful of setting up a system and setting up a scenario where Johnny doesn't cross that line that he so often likes to approach.
And you mentioned at one point the realities of substance abuse, and it is something that, even though there's no evidence that Johnny Manziel is at that point yet, if you are using, you potentially can be abusing, you can potentially develop a dependency, and before you know it, you can find yourself within the gears of the NFL's substance abuse program, which provides assistance to players who really want it, but also eventually provides some pretty strenuous discipline. How do we reconcile the way the NFL treats players who have recurring substance abuse issues with the treatment of Jim Irsay, who, while he's a first offender now, are they going to put him in that same type of predicament where if he can't stay on the straight and narrow, eventually there will be a separation, a clear separation between him and the NFL?
Yeah, I think Roger Goodell has to tread very carefully when dealing with Jim Irsay, because of the very fact that players look at him, and there are programs in place in the NFL. First offense, you're put in the program, you're evaluated. Second offense, you are, it goes further. And I think it's third that you start to get the penalties of getting pay docked and getting the suspension. So I think he's got to be careful here, and I think he's got to send the right message, a balanced message, of what to do with Jim Irsay. And I think Irsay is prepared for the consequences. I think Goodell has to really come out and send a strong message with his discipline, whatever that may be, for Jim Irsay. It's going to be a suspension of some sort. It's probably going to be a fairly hefty fine of some sort that, you know, in Jim Irsay's wallet will amount to about, you know, 10, 20 bucks for the rest of us. But he has to strike a balance here, and the players are looking at him, no question.
Yeah, and that's the problem here. Okay, you suspend him. Okay, wow, he's suspended. I don't know what it means to suspend an owner, and I don't know what it means to financially punish the guy who writes the checks to everyone else. Fining him $1 million, and reportedly that's what it's going to be, that doesn't, to me, address what it really means to be suspended when you're an owner. And I think the amount of money that may have to be taken away from Jim Irsay, or more accurately, the amount of money that he never gets in the first place, money that would otherwise come to him from the league office via the sharing of the revenues, and I don't think anyone believes the NFL is going to do this, but that's the only way to simulate the punishments. And I don't think the NFL is prepared either to simulate the financial punishment or to put Jim Irsay on the kind of treatment and testing program that, if he falters, will get him banished from the NFL. Do you believe either of those things has any chance of happening?
I don't believe that there will be the kind of financial penalty, i.e. taking money away from revenue sharing. I don't think that will happen. I don't think this is going to be a $50 million deal here, which was really what it would have to be to kind of make a dent in his paycheck, so to speak, as it would be for a player. As far as the substance abuse stuff, I think there's a confidentiality situation involved in that. He has gotten treatment, and he has gotten treatment before. He has been open about that for painkillers and prescription drugs. But that's a good question. You know, what if it happens again? And then what do you do? And I think it's a bit of a slippery slope, and that's why Goodell, if he comes out with a strong punishment and a strong set of circumstances that Irsay has to adhere to, you know, what happens that second time, if there is that second time? And we've seen many times that there are those second times, because addiction is a painful process that has many fits and starts. So I don't know the answer to that. I don't know that Goodell knows the answer to that. He's probably hoping he doesn't have to answer that one, and that this punishment will suffice and be strong and prompt Robert Jim Irsay not to do these kind of things again.
Yeah, on the surface, you hold him to a higher standard by suspending him for a first offense, which doesn't happen to a player for a DUI, suspending him before the case is resolved, which doesn't happen to a player. But then on the more subtle points, you're actually holding him to a lesser standard, the financial penalty and also the ongoing and very rigorous thou shalt be tested up to 10 times per month and any false move. And the next thing you know, you're suspended longer. You're kicked out of the league, whatever the case may be. It's going to be a real minefield for Roger Goodell to tiptoe through. The Giants are tiptoeing through an effort to try to improve the team before heads really roll. I know this year's efforts got Kevin Gilbride, the offensive coordinator, fired. I wonder how much higher up the ladder it will go if they don't turn it around. A lot of it hinges on Eli Manning. Is Eli going to be any different, any better this year with the new system in place?
You know, I think he will be. I think it's going to be a difficult adjustment process for him, and I think he is really showing that right now in terms of what he's saying anyway. I had a chance to talk to him last week, and he's still feeling his way through. He's excited about it, and he is very interested to see how this thing will work. But you're talking about a guy who is used to these downfield throws. And Kevin Gilbride's system, and part of the problem with Gilbride is that, you know, his system really relied on those 4, 5, 6 passes down the field that would be home runs and that too often resulted in interceptions and or sacks. For Eli Manning last year, he had career highs in both categories. So, but I think that the high percentage nature of the West Coast offense will help him. But you're talking about a guy who has made a living on 7-step drops throughout his career, now going to these 3-step drops, throwing a slant pass, very conservative type of passing offense that he's going to have to get used to. And you know, he told me he's still dealing with the verbiage. He's got to get the play calls right in the huddle because he's got to spit them out. And if he makes one false move with a word, it changes the whole play or it changes the blocking scheme. So, you know, I think once he gets it, then he's a smart guy. There's no question he's a smart guy. He's diligent, studies, he's bringing work home with him all the time. Once he gets it down, I think he will become more comfortable with it. And I think he will get to the point where it does become second nature, not like a Steve Young who had it throughout his career or Joe Montana, but certainly it'll become more comfortable as he goes along than it is now. You know, Phil Sims, I had a chance to talk to him last week about it. Phil Sims believes that it will be a much smoother transition for Eli Manning, and this offense will benefit him. And, you know, Sims kind of looks at Eli and sees a little bit of himself in there, in that he says, you know, I was 15 years into my career when Dan Reeves came along. 15 years. And I had to go to a new system. I had one of the best years of my career. Went to the Pro Bowl for the second time. Led the Giants to the playoffs. And with a couple of breaks, might have gone to the Super Bowl had they not lost the game to Dallas and not gotten home field advantage. It's a huge year for Phil Sims at age 38 in 1993. And he did great with a new system. So I found it to be interesting that he would kind of look at that and look at himself through Eli Manning's eyes. And Eli should look at that and say, you know what? If Phil Sims can do it 5 years older than I am right now, I don't see why I won't be able to do it too. And one thing Sims kind of commented on, which I found interesting, and you know those passes we talked about in Gilbride's offense where you take those longer shots, take a little bit more risk with those 7-step drops, but even in the West Coast offense, there are plays that Ben McAdoo, the new coordinator, will call that call for those deeper strikes. So I think Eli will kind of be able to have his cake and eat it, have a higher percentage, higher completion percentage because a lot of the passes are going to be shorter timing routes, but still have room for those deeper throws that he can still make, you know, with a Victor Cruz getting down there, with some of his newer receivers, Odell Beckham Jr., whoever it may be, that Eli Manning will still have the opportunity to take the ball and take those strikes down the field.
We will be taking up at some point this week on Pro Football Talk this prime number series that we've been doing all month, the number 10. And there are a couple of guys who have worn, and one of them still wears number 10 for the New York Giants. You've got Eli Manning and Fran Tarkenton. Right now, compare Eli Manning's career to Fran Tarkenton's career, and which of the two would you say is the better overall player in light of what he accomplished, and his era in which he played.
That's a good one. By the way, did you who who are you going to take, Hogaboom at 14 or Otto Graham? You never answered me on that.
Hogaboom? I didn't get the question. I ducked it because I really can't choose between Gary Hogaboom and Otto Graham. I apply the Sean King approach to historical players. If I never actually saw them play, it didn't count. So Gary Hogaboom would be the answer.
All right. That's a really good one with Tarkenton and Eli. And I think the thing you look at, well, Tarkenton had gaudy numbers and just that style that he played where he'd get away from trouble, you know, extend plays maybe better than any quarterback in history, really, because he was just such a great scrambler. He put up the numbers, but he didn't put up championships. And I think that, you know, usually the defining stat for me when trying to compare people, and it's hard to do it, is the championship thing. So probably right here, right now, I take Eli Manning. I know he's coming off a dreadful year. A lot of quarterbacks have dreadful years. Hall of Fame quarterbacks have dreadful years. And Eli certainly has had his worst season, and he's coming off it. But I still think there's more room for Eli Manning and certainly more years ahead for him. He's a healthy quarterback now with his ankle, and I think that the years ahead will generally serve him well. So I think at the end of the day, I would take Eli Manning 10 over Fran Tarkenton 10.
Ooh. See, I disagree. Fran Tarkenton, what he did from a numbers standpoint in the era he played in before all of the rule changes. And Fran Tarkenton himself makes a pretty compelling case for Fran Tarkenton to receive consideration, not as one of the best ever, but as the best quarterback ever when you consider what he did over a sustained period of time in a completely different environment than what the NFL now is. I don't know that I'm willing to go that far, but I think I'd take Fran over Eli, even though Eli's got the two Super Bowl rings and two of the most memorable drives and plays in NFL history on the biggest stage possible. One last topic before we go. I was going to say one last question, but that would guarantee we have five more questions on this topic. Are we losing sight of the fact that with all the talk about the offense and Eli Manning, that the pass rush just is not what it used to be for the Giants, and they really haven't done anything to get it to what it was the 2 years they won the Super Bowl?
I think that is a huge issue that is often clouded and overlooked because of the Eli Manning conundrum that is him coming into this year. And they have not, they've got to get a better pass rush. You know, they have not been the same since OCU Mignola left. Jason Pierre-Paul has got to get back to the way he was dominating by the end of the 2011 season when they won their last championship. Robert Ayers, they're hoping, can provide a little spark on the left side. And DeMontre Moore, they need him to be a breakout player this year. There was some, I mean, he looked terrific in the preseason, all over the place in the game against Pittsburgh, and then did very, very little in the regular season because he still did not adjust to the Giants system very quickly. So if Moore can have that breakout season, and if Pierre-Paul can get back to the level he was at before his injuries started creeping in, you know, I think they'll be much better off. But they absolutely have to manufacture a better pass rush, or else, you know, it doesn't matter how good Eli Manning is, they're not going to be able to stop anybody.
And I still am confounded by the fact that they picked Odell Beckham Jr. over Aaron Donald, and I'm going to be paying close attention to what Aaron Donald does in St. Louis and wondering whether or not he could have been the guy to really help unlock the pass rush for the New York Giants. We'll see how that all plays out. Bob, as always, Glauber Glauber. Maybe I'll just call you that, Bob Glauber Glauber. I'll try that one next time around if I remember. And Bob, thanks as always for your time. We'll be checking out your work at newsday.com, and we look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for having me. I'll talk to you later.
There he is, Bob Glauber Glauber. He probably won't appreciate it if I continue that, which guarantees that I'll probably continue that. The show will continue after the break. If you call, well, even if you don't call, we got some Twitter questions, but I hope you'll call. It's been a few days. 888-237-5269 as always is the phone number. We've got the Twitter questions as always, but we like to hear from you. I like to get a live voice on. I like to have a little repartee, as the case may be. We'll see who calls or who doesn't call when we come back. This is PFT Live. It is PFT Planet Time. There's the logo. The kind of, what is that? It's not really a globe. It's kind of like the flattened globe. It's the globe that's been run over by a steamroller. It's time to answer your questions rather than listen to whatever crap comes out of my mouth, which is pretty much what this show is all about, yet they have not canceled it although who knows when they will. Hopefully, not until after I've answered this question from at Jay Rasman. Is Nick Foles a franchise quarterback, or is Chip Kelly's system so QB-friendly that Philly won't want to pay him? Answer, we don't know. And here's the big reason why we don't know. And we debated this a little bit last night on Pro Football Talk, Ross Tucker and Eric Casilius and yours truly, talking about between Tony Romo, Matthew Stafford, and Nick Foles, which one we would want over the next 3 or 4 years. My concern with Foles, we really don't know how teams are going to react to him. And it's one thing to have the guy that everyone thought was going to be the backup show up out of the blue after Mike Vick is injured, and then you have week in and week out opportunities to try to crack the code and figure out how to stop him. What tells are there in what he does? How can you confound him? How can you confuse him? How can you beat him? It's a lot easier to do that when you have an entire offseason to do it. And the Giants, the Cowboys, and the Redskins all have a strong incentive this offseason to study what Nick Foles did well, what he didn't do well, whatever little tweaks or tells there may be in his game, whatever possible predictions they can make about how they can attack him. And they spend and should spend the full offseason trying to figure it out. We will know whether or not Nick Foles can bust through that ceiling based on how he performs in 2014. And at that point, we'll know, the team will know, and everyone will know, really, whether or not this guy's a franchise quarterback. And then the Eagles will have to ask themselves, do we make the financial investment now? Do we make it later? Do we let it play out? Do we do like the 49ers did and offer a contract that really was team-friendly? As I said last week, if I'm any team with a young franchise quarterback, I offer him the same terms that Colin Kaepernick got in San Francisco. Will Nick Foles want more? Jeff McClain of the Philadelphia Inquirer pointed out over the weekend that Nick Foles' father sold a chain of restaurants for $59 million a few years ago. So it really isn't about the money for Nick Foles. So will he do a team-friendly deal? What will he do? How will he address the contractual conundrum that is going to come up after this season? But I say for now, it's too early to know whether it's him or whether it's the system. Because if it's the system, then you got to find somebody else who can come in and run it. And maybe Chip Kelly can find someone else to come in and run it. But I think it's more important to have a year-to-year franchise quarterback that you know is going to be your guy over the next decade. Another question on Twitter from at Jeff Glauber. Will EJ Manuel take a big step forward this season or bust? Who knows? They're doing everything they can to help EJ Manuel by trading up 5 spots to Sammy Watkins, mortgaging the future to a certain extent, giving up that first-round pick in 2015, fourth-round pick in 2015, all to get Sammy Watkins. It seems like the effort is there to get the most out of EJ Manuel. My concern is he can't stay healthy. And if you have a quarterback who has issues staying healthy, your best way to keep him healthy is to keep him from getting hit. Your best way to keep him getting hit is to have better blockers. So I would have preferred standing pat at number 9, taking a tackle, and then if you really want to go all in and make a splash, go after Jimmy Graham. Bring him to town. Give up your first-round pick in 2015 and 2016 rather than giving up your first-round pick in 2014 and 2015 plus a fourth-round pick to get Sammy Watkins. So if you really want to get the most out of EJ Manuel, I think it's more about the offensive line than it is about the receiver. The jury will remain to be out on EJ Manuel, but it's clear that the Bills are doing everything they can to try to get the most out of EJ Manuel, and a lot of jobs may be riding on whether or not that ultimately happens. Next up, Chris in Illinois. Welcome to PFT Live.
Hey, Mike. My question is kind of two-part about the potential developmental leagues. First, would you see the structure being kind of like how baseball and basketball does, where a team would draft a player and they would play for that team under, like, that city? So, like, Philadelphia would have a farm team and you would move up the ranks there, or would it be kind of NFL run where these players can kind of show their talent if they didn't do enough in college and then play, and then they would be drafted from there? And then also, when do you think this could take place? How long would it take the NFL to kind of put this in motion?
And thank you. I mean, great questions all around, and no one knows the specific format that a developmental league would take. I'm a firm believer in doing a true minor league system that unfolds during football season in markets not currently served by the NFL, where you have true call-ups and send-downs and guys who are using the same systems offensively and defensively, ready to go when you have an injury need. Up the guy comes, down the guy goes. To do that, ideally, you'd need to have 32 teams. And I think the NFL is concerned about diluting the NFL by putting teams in these markets that fans would maybe feel a strong affinity to. I mean, if let's say there would be a team, and I don't think there would be a team in Morgantown, West Virginia, but what if you develop a fan base that is more loyal to that team than to the Pittsburgh Steelers, which folks in Morgantown seem to follow. I don't think you want to do that if you're in the NFL. That's why I think the spring is going to be the appropriate time, even though it may not be the ideal time, March, April, May, June. And also, and yes, I do know my calendar. I learned it only recently. And also, I think it would be a small number of teams, 6 or 8 teams to start with. And then it would be almost like it was with the World League. Maybe you would have some loose affiliations, multiple teams associated with certain developmental teams, different rights, dibs, whatever. You send guys down, you let them play. They have an opportunity to join your 90-man roster once the season ends. A lot of questions to be answered, but the bottom line is the NFL needs this. The NFL has been missing it since NFL Europe, the World League, NFL Europa, whatever it was called, and it had multiple different names. That was shuttered several years ago because of the costs. There's a way to do it. I think the belief is it would be regional to hold down the cost, especially from a travel standpoint. It wouldn't be a lot of teams, but it gives young players opportunities to get game reps. It gives coaches and officials and GMs opportunities to learn the craft, because as of right now, there's only 32 teams. There's only so many seats at the table, and there are more guys who can do the jobs than there are opportunities at the NFL. Next opportunity to answer a question comes from at @ClamSwan. What's the latest on Justin Blackmon? He appears to have vanished into thin air, #Jaguars. Well, the latest we had heard about Justin Blackmon, and this was coming off of a report from Ed Werder of ESPN last week or so, we confirmed that the Jaguars intend to reinstate and accept Justin Blackmon back to the team if and when he is reinstated and accepted by the NFL. Jaguars believe, I'm told, that it'll happen at some point in 2014 if everything continues to go as currently envisioned. Not week one, but at some point during the season. And look, it makes sense for the Jaguars to be patient with this guy, even though the current GM, Dave Caldwell, the current head coach, Gus Bradley, had nothing to do with the selection of Blackmon. He's shown that when he can play very, very well. And also, just from a humanitarian standpoint, the Jaguars realize, I believe, that by holding out that reality, that Blackmon will have a job. He's working towards something. He has a goal. Because you're cast out into the wilderness. It's one of the problems with the NFL's substance abuse program. When you get that one-year suspension, I can recall Brett Favre being very passionate about this back when Corn Robinson was a member of the Packers and was suspended for a year. The guy's thrown out. He's gone. He doesn't have that support system, doesn't have that structure. You're better off having that structure. The next best thing is to give the guy hope. And that's what the Jaguars are doing. They got nothing to lose at this point, but Blackmon has to continuously be in a position where he can choose football over whatever the substance is. And some think it's marijuana, some think it's alcohol, maybe it's both. But whatever the substance is that is keeping him out of the game, he has to consistently choose football. And at a certain point, and I know personal responsibility is a big part of this, at a certain point, though, I wonder how much of a choice it is. And if the NFL is going to have that kind of compassion for Jim Irsay, they better have that kind of compassion for the players out there. One last question from our very loyal and consistent C. Crawl. At what point does it make sense for the NFL to sell live games a la carte via streaming? Well, it makes sense when the NFL realizes that it can't make money anymore, forcing you to buy all or nothing. And as it stands right now, the package comes as part of the Sunday NFL ticket. If you have DirecTV and if you subscribe to Sunday NFL ticket, you can stream the games over your laptop. Certain games stream via the NFL mobile service, if you have Verizon, the primetime games, etc. At some point, yeah, it'll make sense for the NFL to allow people who want to watch one game to pay the price to watch one game. And why not do that? Why not make that available? Why not charge $50 to watch one game? If I live in California and I'm a Cowboys fan and Cowboys-Eagles isn't on that weekend anywhere for me to see it, why can't I dial it up? And I understand the NFL, I think the NFL ultimately is concerned about charging too much for the ability to watch these games because of the notion that the NFL is founded on broadcasting games through free TV and the NFL has the broadcast antitrust exemption. And if you start creating the impression of being too greedy about how the rights are disseminated to people who are out of market, that can create some issues with the broadcast antitrust exemption. And that's the key, I think, to push and pull the NFL in a lot of different directions, whether it's the name of the Redskins, whether it's other issues. That threat of the broadcast antitrust exemption going away is the kind of thing that can get the NFL's attention. And at a time when the NFL is so big and so powerful, there aren't many things that the NFL is afraid of. I guarantee you, the NFL is afraid of losing that broadcast antitrust exemption. I'm afraid of losing our audience, so I'm going to set you free for today and invite you to come back tomorrow. You can go back and do all the other things you do, which hopefully include checking us out around the clock at ProFootballTalk.com. Tune in at 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time tonight. Prime Numbers series continues. Half-hour show. We hope to see you there. We hope to see you here tomorrow at noon Eastern Time. We hope to see you all the time, every day of the year at ProFootballTalk.com. Have a great day.